So we will go ahead and call the meeting, the regular and the supplemental meetings to order, and we'll recess the supplemental meeting, and we'll start the regular meeting as normal with a moment of silence for the past police officers and one firefighter who passed during the month of June. It's on page 6 of the diligence, so let's just take a moment of silence now. Okay, thank you. The next item is the approval of the minutes of our last meeting. It's gone pages 7 to 11 or 12. Anybody have any comments or corrections?
I'll make a motion there, Chairman.
Thank you, Gilbert. And we have a second?
I'll second.
That was Susan. Yeah, just mention who you are. That way they can record who's doing that. That would be appreciated. All
yes,
in
sir.
Favor? Or anybody opposed, say okay. Okay, that's unanimous then. The next item is the detailed consent agenda. It starts on page 14. Kelly, I usually ask you anything unusual, anything you want to point out on?
Yes, Bill. Good morning, everyone. The only thing I wanted to point out was item number 7 on the consent agenda is the earnings test that we do for members that have a disability retirement. And these two members, their income from other employment exceeded their allowable limit. So their DPFP pension will be reduced according to the plan for the next 12 months. So that's an item you only see once a year. That's all I have.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, Kelly? Hearing none, can we get a motion to approve the detailed consent agenda?
So moved. Gilbert. Second, Gilbert.
Was that Nick second? Did I hear?
Sure, I'll second it. Yeah, Nick, second.
Okay, great. Thank you, Nick. Okay, anybody opposed to approving the detailed agenda? Not hearing anything. It's approved. Next is to see if anybody in the public wants to comment on anything before we get into the more lengthy agenda.
If you'll press 5. Star, that'll raise your hand and I'll unmute you. Bill, I'm not seeing anybody.
Okay, good enough. Thank you, John. Thanks, everybody. Let's move on to the agenda item is the update on our financial audit status with Brenda.
Thank you, Bill. Good morning, everyone. The work on our annual audit continues. We've completed about 80% of the auditor request. Our largest outstanding items continue to be audited financial statements from a couple of our investments. Once we receive those remaining investment financial statements, then we'll be able to forward information to the actuaries, complete the financial statements. It'll take about 60 days from the time we receive those final financial statements until the completion of the audit and the issuance of the financial report.
We're getting some background information. Well, so if people can mute it, and then just go back on when they have a question or something, that would be appreciated. Thank you. Now, Brenda, are the two that were Lone Star and Huff, there are others?
Yes, the two that are outstanding are Lone Star and Huff. Lone Star had indicated maybe around June 30th. We received another update. It just said soon. So we're hoping to receive them at least during July. Huff, I do not have an estimated time for when we might receive Huff financial statements.
Morning, but I don't know what else. Any questions for Brenda? We actually, the audit committee is going to meet with the auditors after the meeting today. The status on their view on the audit, which I'm sure won't be very different, and also to discuss their PCAOB results, which were not all that great in the last audit released. Report back to that next month to find out. Okay, if no questions, Kelly, do you want to get a contribution report?
Yes, thank you. The contribution report for July is attached. It's based on the May data. There were two pay periods in May. The city hiring in May continues to be on track. They are actually 50 employees over the hiring plan. Fire is over by 81, and the police are short by 31. So they're in total over their estimate by 50 employees. I expect that to go down, but hopefully it won't go down too much. On the page 19, you can see the summary. And again, the numbers are on track, as you've seen for the last probably year, really. Month to date, we have 97% of the floor, 106% of the hiring plan. And since the bill was put in place, we're at 90% of the floor, 99% of the hiring plan. So things are on track there. The only thing that I'm a little bit cautious of at this point is the city is doing a massive payroll software change, which is a huge deal, especially for a city the size of Dallas and the age of their current payroll system. They went live with the civilian plan last week, and they're going live with the uniform personnel this week. So we will be, we'll continue to work with them just to make sure that we are receiving all of the contributions that we are expected to receive and all of the information we're expected to receive, but also have the access so we can continue to do what we need to do to serve our members. So hopefully won't cause any hiccups, but they've been very cooperative and working with us. And we know we are one piece of a very big change. So, you know, we understand that. We're trying to work with them, but it does worry us a little bit. So we're keeping track of that. With that, I'll take any questions anybody has on this report.
Made a lot of progress in the last year, so on track and even improve it.
Right.
Hey, you're going to cover the funding policy change?
Before I do that, I would like to actually just spend a minute on the trustee education and travel. On page 24 of Diligent, although no trustee has asked to be approved for any trustee education at this point, I wanted to point out to you that NCFERS is doing free virtual training classes that you can do. They're an hour long apiece, and there's four of them that are listed in this report with the link. You just click on the link, and you can take the class. You'll get an hour of credit for that, and again, they're free. There's one today at noon if, you know, we get out of the board meeting and you're just dying to get one done. That's there for you. So I just wanted to point out that those are there. You don't need approval to do those because there's no cost to the system. There is a class that's listed, which is the MCFERS pension funding form at the bottom of page 24. That one would need board approval. That's not until August. In the past, I've been to that, actually, in person, not virtually. It's been one of the better NCFERS programs. I'm not sure how old it is virtually, but that's for you to see as well. And I just wanted to remind the trustees that there are four trustees that have their 4 hours of continuing ed due at the end of August of this year. That's Bill, Nick, Gilbert, and Tina. And then the seven newer trustees, Alan, Mark, and Steve, all need to do their core courses by November 27th of 2020, and everybody else is in 2021-22. If you ever have any questions, contact me or Carol, and we can help you figure out what you need to do and when.
Okay.
Are there any questions on that? Okay, thank you. On the funding policy item, last month, you'll recall, I asked the board to amend the supplemental funding policy. And in the supplemental funding policy, that plan is actually funded based on the actuarially determined contribution, the ABC calculation that the actuary does annually. And I had thought that because the contributions are based on the ABC, that was the only policy we needed to change. But in talking with the PRB, they say even though our contributions aren't based on the ABC and the combined plan or regular plan, we also need to change that policy. So, again, you're seeing a funding policy here on the agenda. I'm sorry I didn't have them both together last month for you. But this change is to be in compliance with the PRB board's actions related to how they're interpreting SB 2224. And what this is doing is it's creating a closed funding period to calculate the ABC, the actuarially determined contribution. It doesn't change the funding level of the plan. It doesn't change the amount of assets that are available. It doesn't change the city's contribution rate. The only thing that this change will do is in the actuarial valuation, there is a page where the ABC is compared with the actual contributions received. So that gap between those two numbers will be bigger than it was before. But at this point, it has no other impact. So this policy is changing the 30-year open period to a 25-year closed period for the actuarial liability at 1/1/2020, and then future gains and losses will be amortized over a 20-year funding period. And this is a layered approach which was similar to the supplemental plan. In the supplemental plan, however, the periods are shorter. Instead of 25 and 20 years, they were 20 and 10 years. But that's because that plan is so much smaller. Are there any questions on the funding policy?
Still getting some background noise. I don't know what that is, but try to mute again. Anybody has any questions? If not, can we get a motion to approve policy as amended?
So moved. This is Gilbert.
Thank you, Gilbert. Second?
I'll second, Susan.
Okay, anybody opposed? Okay, then it carries. Thanks, everybody. Our next item was going to be the Investment Advisory Committee, but we're going to cover that in closed session since personnel is due. Come back to it in open session when we reopen. As usual, we try to keep all the open item session items together so the much as spend a lot of time waiting for us to come back. And today we have a couple of items, so it. So we're going to move on to items, which is the portfolio update. Kent?
I'm here. Took me a second to. I have been on mute there, so just, everyone knows that. So I am on, we'll go to page 35 in the slide deck, which is the asset allocation. And really not a lot exciting here. If you look kind of about a third of the way down at fixed income and the safety reserve item there, you'll see we have $61 million in cash. Who's ever typing? You're the culprit. So who's ever typing right now, please go on mute. And so the we have $61 million in cash. We're trying to keep $50 in there. We got some distributions, private market distributions in June. So that put us a little bit up, and we'll draw that down in July, and then we, you know, absent any other distributions, we'll continue to draw from the next safety reserve item, the short-term investment grade bonds, and you'll see that that's slightly below target right now at 214. And then hopefully, you know, later in the year, early next year, we'll have some of the lumpy and larger private market distributions that will allow us to fill that back up and fill up the investment grade bond allocation. But we have, you know, there's about on average $10 million a month. If you look down at the very bottom, kind of safety reserve aggregate is $275 million. So we have, you know, more than 2 years of payments there. And just before I move to the next page, which will be the adjusted asset allocation, just note that that kind of private markets before the adjustment is $832 million. We'll move to the next slide now, slide 36. And you'll see that that same number, that 832, dropped to 602. And what that is that this is staff's kind of rough estimation of the current value of these assets. And, you know, a lot of, Ryan will talk about this some more, so we'll go into much detail, but it's, you know, a lot of these are lagged values, and we're trying to kind of have a feeling for what our portfolio is worth in the moment. Going to the next slide, slide 37. Just a few, here I want to focus more on the year-to-date. If you look at the global equity line, which is kind of the top shaded line at the far right, you'll see kind of the excess return versus the overall benchmark is slightly negative, minus 3 basis points, so essentially with the with the benchmark. And yes, that's really continues to be a growth value story where our growth managers, Invesco and Walter Scott, are outperforming, and they're doing well, but they do have a value or a growth tailwind there, and our value-oriented managers, Boston Partners and Manulife, Life have been lagging, and kind of that's really the story there. We have Boston Partners has been, kind of really honing that value benchmark, and so, we're glad to see them outperforming the value benchmark year-to-date. Looking down at fixed income, again, we're looking at that far-right column there, we've underperformed a fixed income, but that's mostly due to kind of the Brandywine, as well as the overall benchmark issues. So just a couple things to point out here is so Brandywine, which had a bit, hard first quarter, they came back in the second quarter, but they still haven't erased their underperformance for the year. And Vanguard, that's kind of more of a benchmark measurement issue there, and kind of we're shifting that portfolio over to Longfellow. And, then the other guys have all kind of are positive for the year. I'm really happy to see the Loomis High Yield portfolio outperform in both the first and the second quarter. Pacific Asset Management, they had a little bit of a loss in the second, underperformed the second quarter, but strong year to date. I'll move on to the next slide, 38, and just briefly here. It's a very busy chart, but this is where go ahead, Phil.
Can you comment on Ashmore for a minute? That's year to date.
They had, it's, first of all, they're estimated, so we don't know exactly what we've got with those guys. Actually, we got their numbers in late yesterday, and they did a little bit better than this in the second quarter. And, they had, issues with Argentina and I think Turkey, and that hurt them in the first quarter. They're overweight to emerging markets in general, and that has hurt them. And I'll just stop and see if Mike Ian has any additional comments on that. I'll hit the key issues. Not hearing from Mike, we'll proceed on. Those are the main issues there. We've taken a harder look at them, and they are doing what they do. They continue to follow their investment process and policy and philosophy, and they just got caught up in some of that EM in the first quarter.
Hey, sorry, Kent, I was on mute.
Good man. Any did I catch it or have any other comments there, Mike?
No, I mean they're bouncing back as things are rallying, and we have conviction in that philosophy and believe that they should continue to catch up.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. Back on that slide 38, folks on the top line here, and really that the far right, you know, we've lost $33.6 million kind of from public markets year to date. And so that's not great, but it's much better than the, you know, $153 million negative we were showing at the end of the first quarter. And then just a couple of high points on that far right column. You know, we, with that growth tailwind, OFI is actually, so we have an equity manager that's actually up for the year. Walter Scott, just a small loss there. And again, it's that growth value story. And then our protective asset classes are working. So we made money with the investment grade bond, $3.5 million. We made a little money, or made a decent amount of money at the short-term bonds, $7.3 million. So that's good. And moving forward to the next slide, the investment initiatives, slide 39. We always kind of think of our time between board meetings as, you know, short or long. So this was a short one with 4 weeks, and we got some work done on the investment policy, which we'll talk about in a second. And actually quite a bit of work in the private markets, both with Lone Star and Huff. So that's where most of our energy has been expected been expended. We did finish the contract with Longfellow. We actually made our initial investment with them on Tuesday just to avoid the transition risk. And we're using cash. We'll do that in three tranches. So we'll be doing that in the next couple of weeks. And then we have the IPS revision. Also with the core missions on the Investment Advisory Committee, as well as the fact that we had met in March. And while that was mainly focused on the bond manager, we did review the portfolio, so we canceled that meeting. Once we get the new investment advisory committee on members on board, we'll have an initiation with them, and then we'll have our regularly scheduled meeting, which will be in September. Or, you know, we'll meet sooner if we need to. No progress on these other issues, although we're hoping to get on those soon. And then on the investment review calendar, so we'll Greg Earlbeck will talk about the infrastructure, and then we'll keep going through the portfolio as we go through the year. Any questions on the portfolio for
I don't know, Leo, do you have anything you want to add?
Yes, Bill, and thank you, Ken, for the observations. I'll just make one comment on the safety reserve, income research and management. Obviously, in the first quarter, it lagged, but then it outperformed and recouped more than it had lost on a relative basis versus the benchmark. And these match exactly our expectations. Our first decision, as you may recall, back in April of 2018 or May, was to figure out, okay, are we going to put additional monies with income research and management, knowing that they take a bit more credit
Hello.
Yeah, Leo, we lost you.
Hello.
This is Aaron. I'll jump in for what I believe he was getting at. So I think his point was that they do take a little more credit risk than the index, which is more heavily weighted in treasuries. So you'd expect and hope that they would rebound stronger in a quarter like second quarter, and they did. So happy to see that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions on the portfolio update? Bill, you want me to go on into the investment policy?
Sure.
Okay, so this would be slide 41, and this is really just some kind of clarifying language. We found this when we were rebalancing in the midst of the drawdown. There's some mathematical dynamics that are going on that kind of caused us to lose touch with the, or not lose touch, but we no longer were kind of, we didn't have any reference to the $300 million kind of dollar target for the safety reserve. So stepping back a second, kind of the safety reserve is designed to provide 2.5 years of expected net cash flows, and that's about $10 million a month or $300 million. And so our allocation of 3% to cash and 12% to short-term bonds on a $2 billion fund gets us right at $3 billion. But if we drop, you know, if we vary from that significantly, then we could be, you know, lose touch with that 2.5 years. And so all we've done here is add some language that doesn't change any of the allocations. It just provides a reference point and allows us, requires us to consider both the safety reserve in both dollar terms and percentage terms when we are rebalancing. And so you'll see that language a couple of pages forward on slide 43. And a lot of red there, but it's, you know, the key is there kind of about halfway down. It says staff and consultant will evaluate the size of safety reserve in both dollar terms and percentage terms when making rebalancing recommendations. And the rest of it is just kind of clarifying about the purpose of the safety reserve. And then the last line of that paragraph, just is kind of similar to what we had before, which is a safety reserve is not required to be rebalanced to target if deemed prudent by staff and consultant. And then two pages forward on 45, all we've done is kind of make sure that that language was consistent for the safety reserve in items 1 and 2. So there was quite a bit of work here in looking at different ways to do this, and you know, and should we be kind of, should we carve out the safety reserve? But it, all of the kind of anything else really caused more problems than that were bigger than the solution they were solving. So this seemed like the best approach. We worked very closely with Makita on this. This is actually their primarily their language, and so so since Makita was, go ahead, Tina.
So it seems like a lot of the revisions were based on these kind of hard lines, 2.5 or 15. And my question to you is, shouldn't we use the language that gives us some flexibility if those parameters change? I mean, it could get worse. It could get better. I mean, do we hard code an investment policy for what we are today and not really think about how this would change? Seems very little in flexibility because all of this is rooted in how we're looking at our reserve today.
Thanks, Tina. And
this was the intent originally, and I think, Tina, a policy statement is not cast in stone, just like we're coming back to amend it now. If the environment changes, we should be looking at this thing on a very relatively frequent basis and make amendments as necessary. So I don't think it's really hard-coded the way it is.
And maybe that's my misinterpretation. I felt like an investment policy should kind of weather a little bit of volatility in the markets or changes in the situation. But if you're saying to me, Bill, that I shouldn't look at the investment policy that way, then that's a different way that I was looking at it.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, we've got these ranges, minimums, maximums, gives us pretty, but anytime we want to revisit anything based on the environment or our own views, we, just like we're bringing it back now, staff should be bringing it back, or the Makita or the IAC. It's a living document, not cast in stone.
So, just Kent, a couple comments on that, and then I'll pass it over to Makita for their view. But so first of all, Bill, you just talked about the ranges, and we do have wider ranges for the safety reserve that give us some leeway. Also, the last line of that paragraph 3, and John, if you go to slide 43, please, where it says the safety reserve is not required to rebalance the target if deemed prudent by staff and consultant. That's what addresses the flexibility that we need in kind of volatile times, so that we're not forced to do something just to comply with the IPS. We're allowed to be sensible. And also, the investment policy requires us to do an asset allocation study every 3 years, but to look at the asset allocation every year. And the thought is that, you know, if either the rate of payment changes, so say we moved from 10 to either 11 or 9, you know, that would cause us to update the language. Or if the overall fund changed, say we were at, you know, $1.5 billion or $2.5 billion, all of those would require us to come in and make a slight modification to, you know, address that issue. Leo, any comments on this, your perspective?
No, Kent, and I'm sorry I dropped earlier. from the call. But no, I think he hit, between you and Bill, hit all the points. The reality is we constantly review the asset allocation. If there's any meaningful material changes, we will be reviewing and addressing that, and it may lead to a different change to the safety reserve. Formally, we'll do that at least every 3 years. We'll review it informally at least once a year, but in practice, every quarter, we're just making sure and essentially validating that, reaffirming that the asset allocation mix is appropriate. So each time there's a change to the asset mix, it will be reflected on the policy statement. Best practice is also to update the policy statement once a year. You may make no changes, but at least, again, reaffirm that, you know, it is still the best living document you can have. And so I think we have the right language now with enough flexibility if it is needed, and we have a process in place so that at the latest, at the end of next year, we'll be wrapping up another asset allocation study, and in that case, it may be updated as needed.
Thanks, Leo. Any other questions on the investment policy?
That actually helps me in looking at the investment policy procedures.
Thank you.
Okay. Are we where we need to? Any other questions before we ask for a motion to approve the proposed amendment to the policy? Okay. Hearing none, can we get a motion to approve the amended policy?
So moved. Tina. Gilbert.
Okay. Tina, you were second on that, I believe.
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody oppose the approval? Hearing none, we approve. Okay, next we're going to move on to the infrastructure portfolio review.
Great, and I'm just going to hand it over to Greg Earlbeck to talk about the infrastructure portfolio. Again, this is just a regular kind of, as we're going through the portfolio, nothing, we're not asking for anything here. So, Greg, go ahead and give us this brief review of infrastructure.
Thank you, Kent. So if we think of the infrastructure asset class as a whole, it's basically in wind-down mode. They're not making any new investments. They're operating and trying to monetize the investments that they have. And also, as an asset class, we're trying to move towards our target allocation of 0%. So at the present, we have three funds that remain. It's the J.P. Morgan Global Maritime Investment Fund, the Reuton Group, which is abbreviated as TRG. It's Asian Infrastructure and Related Resources Opportunity Funds 1 and 2. So you'll hear us refer to those as Arrow 1 and 2. Right now, we expect it will probably take 3 to 5 years for the funds to fully liquidate all of the assets. In more recent news, the overall portfolio valuation decreased about 13% in Q1 of 2020, and this is really due to significant effects from the COVID pandemic. We saw within the Maritime Fund dramatic decreases, obviously, in global trade, and then within the Aero 1 and 2 funds, we're seeing, due to effects of the lockdown in India, they basically halted toll road collections. Power demand was down about 25% with regards to consumption, and then spot prices in the tariff market were down about 40%, and that really kind of compressed margins within the power companies there. So at the moment, you know, COVID did have a significant effect on the portfolio. If you'll move to slide 49. So the first fund we'll cover is the Global Maritime Investment Fund. This fund is a 2009 vintage fund. The idea behind it was to take advantage of the global financial crisis situation that was created, where a lot of new build ship contracts were not being completed due to companies canceling contracts, companies not being able to finance the contracts. And so J.P. Morgan's idea was to take advantage of the opportunity and buy some of these new build ship contracts at pretty much 60 cents on the dollar. and get a fleet of vessels up and running, and by the time the ships are built and on the water, contract rates should have improved. And so you've got an income component as well as a capital appreciation component. So J.P. Morgan's completed kind of phase one of this, which was to get all of the ships built. So all of the ships now are on the water and operating. The issue is that contract rates, especially now due to COVID, haven't really improved back to the levels that they were before the global financial crisis. Now, most of the ships are still operating in a profit despite these lower contract rates, but it's having an effect, obviously, on the fund returns. More recently, the fund was extended by approximately 2 years. It was originally set to expire in December of 2020, and the fund asked for investors to approve an extension to 2022, feeling that they could maximize value by being able to hopefully have better market conditions down the road that maximize value as they start to sell some of the ships. So the future performance is going to be really based on the income from the charter rates and any sales proceeds from the ships. And, of course, COVID has affected to varying degrees across all the shipping segments. J.P. Morgan quarterly kind of put out an estimate of what they expect the total fund return to be, and that has been declining recently. We're really now looking at, unfortunately, a negative IRR in probably the single digits and a total multiple on invested capital of a 0.8x. Any questions on the Maritime Fund? Okay, hearing none. If we'll go on to slide 50, please. The next is the TRG, which is the Royton Group Asian Infrastructure Fund. Again, a 2008 vintage fund. This fund was originally established to take advantage of infrastructure opportunities across all of Asia. They did have assets in China. They had assets in Korea that they successfully exited. The fund now is composed of assets that are only in India. And we basically have hospitals, toll roads, wind power, and a thermal power asset, which is called Diligent, that's also shared with the Aero 2 fund. In May of 2018, J.P. Morgan was the original fund sponsor, but they facilitated a transfer of the GP to the Royton Group. Now, since the Royton Group, or TRG, took over, they have been very successful in getting some really critical financing in place across several of the projects. And that really, you know, essentially saved a lot of these assets. The issue now with COVID is that, you know, well, now the assets are kind of highly leveraged. And right now they're still making the debt service, and actually there's a moratorium through August of 2020 on debt service, which is really helping the cash flow on these assets. That being said, we're still expecting probably 2 to 3 years for the assets to be sold. And the assets still face some regulatory and financial hurdles to monetization. There was a sale process on Diligent Power that unfortunately was put on hold until conditions kind of stabilized from the effects of COVID. And lastly, we should mention that even though we saw some downside valuation adjustments in Q1 of 2020, TRG expects that we could see continued risk of downside valuations in the quarters ahead as they came out with new GDP estimates in India and that are going to be lower than what they had originally expected. So still a lot of uncertainty as far as the overall outcome. But there is still good potential for upside as conditions normalize. Any questions on this Aero Fund?
I have a quick question. This is Gilbert. it's more of a broader question than just the fund, but in general, when one of these funds perform poorly, I mean, I understand the carry and so forth they may not get. Is there any provision about the fee being reduced from the 2%?
So, in general, on the performance basis, the answer, the short answer is no. Now, when they put out for an extended term, they did put out basically for a fee reduction, at least on the Arrow Fund, of if they don't have one asset 100% sold by January of 20, then they would have a 12.5% reduction in management fee. And then if they don't have an asset 100% sold by January of 21, then they would reduce another 12.5%. Obviously, they didn't meet the January 21, so it's a bit of a reduced management fee at the present. And then, you know, it's really based on performance with regards to monetizing assets before January 21.
When you
Greg,
say
this is Ken. I'm going to just jump in on a couple things there, Gilbert. On TRG, and we had mentioned this last year, whenever they extended, DPFP took the lead, and we pushed them hard. And we worked with a limited partners group, and we got that kind of to what I view as the, you know, absolute best outcome in terms of them standing up. And those guys walked into a situation, it wasn't like they had been collecting management fees for years and years. So we pushed hard there. It's important to us. And then on the JP Maritime Fund, you know, we knew that it needed to be extended, but we pushed them there to, you know, for a lower fee, but we didn't have enough LP support on that. So they ended up, you know, the extension kind of, we opposed it, but they were able to get that through anyway. So,
Ken, let me ask you this. So then on the carried interest side, is it a cumulative thing? So in other words, they're going to have to make it all back up before that can kick in going forward in the future?
Greg, I don't think we're looking at carried, any kind of carried interest on these funds, are we?
Yeah.
If it rebounds strongly, they have to make it back up before it kicks in, right, or not?
Yeah.
Yes.
If there was a huge upside, yeah, that's true.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, I mean, generally this was the format most of these things went at. I think the market has forced these down, and now they're charging closer to 1.5% and a 15% carry. But in the past, sometimes the carry was deal by deal, not on a cumulative basis, but it has evolved to a cumulative basis. So I would think that's probably the case here.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah, just quick wrap.
I'm sorry?
I said just a quick wrap-up on Aero 2 there. We already kind of know what that is.
If you don't have any other questions, let's move to slide 51, please. So the Aero 2 fund, same premise was to get developmental and operating assets in infrastructure across Asia. However, in about mid-2017, J.P. Morgan's internal forecasts with regards to that sector in emerging markets changed, and they were not seeing investment opportunities that they felt were going to generate the types of returns that were commensurate with the risk involved. And so they terminated the investment period on this fund, and the fund ends up basically with one asset, which is Diligent Power, which is a thermal power asset that, as we mentioned before, is shared with the Aero 1. When you think of that asset, there's really two assets. One is an operating facility that's constructed and complete and has some contracted power and does power in the spot markets. The other is a development opportunity. Now, with COVID, the operating asset faced some significant declines with regards to production. Based, again, what we saw is a 25% decrease in consumption demand and 40% decrease in the tariff markets. So they shut down production to about 50% of capacity. More recently, they're back up to about 70% of capacity. But the future still kind of depends on them getting long-term power purchase agreements. On the development side, that asset essentially put on hold because of market conditions, and the power purchase agreement market in India kind of ground to a halt. So they recently refinanced and are seeking a strategic partner to maybe begin construction. But again, it really depends on the prospect of the power purchase agreement market coming back to a normal state. And that's the asset also we see where there was a sale process in place, but after the effects of COVID and the uncertainty surrounding future production, it's basically stalled out at this point. So we would still expect probably 2 to 3 years before we see monetization of this one. Are there any other questions?
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
Bill, can we turn over to Ryan to talk about private market cash flows?
Yep.
Okay. Ryan?
All right. Hey, everyone. Just as a reminder, kind of purpose of these reports is to keep our eye on the ball in respect to the private market distributions, make sure we're touching it at least once a quarter with the board. Give us a chance to give you guys any relevant updates on the private market portfolio that we wouldn't otherwise be covering. At a high level, there wasn't a ton of change quarter to quarter. We saw uptick in distributions quite a bit from Q1, where we only had $4 million. But until we start to see some new sales activity post-COVID, we're still flying somewhat blind on any of the estimates and projections that we're putting in here. The two big sales that happened in Q2 were kind of in the hopper before March, so we'd like to see some new activity. We have some positive signs, but nothing has closed materially since March. And then just a reminder and disclaimer, nature of these reports, the way we do it with the projections over a 2 to 4 year schedule is to kind of smooth out distributions, but we continue to expect to see quite a bit of lumpiness in sales as they occur. John, if you could jump ahead to 56. So at June 30, the reported NAV for the private markets portfolio was $832 million. That's down from $855 million in Q1. And then going to the next slide, the activity we saw in Q2, we had one capital call with Industry Ventures for $160,000. Newer vintage venture fund, so it's expected. I think we're down to $1.5 million or so in unfunded there. We saw $17.5 million in distributions. To mention, the big chunks of that were AEW from the Union sale, $10 million coming back, and then sale at Museum Tower. Both of those sales were either closed or under contract in early March. So we also saw a little bit coming out of the Huff Alternative Fund, residual from the sale that occurred late last year, $750,000 in the ag portfolio, normal monthly income on Vista, and then a distribution of Riverstone. So the 17.5 decent number, up quite a bit from the $4 million we saw in Q1. And then going ahead to 59, John. Kind of a detailed view at what Ken mentioned earlier on the staff estimates of a more current market value in the private market portfolio. We focus on the chart at the bottom of the page, what we're calling the reported NAV. That's what's on the books right now. That's, you know, our carrying value for the private markets portfolio. Right now, it's kind of based on a blend of 12/31 and Q1 values that have been reported. We still have a few that we talked about earlier that are still 9/30 waiting for year-end numbers. But what we're doing is we're taking an asset-by-asset view and making adjustments depending on nature of the asset. You know, as you guys know, we have a ton of energy exposure in the private equity portfolio, so we're taking heavier discounts there. And then on real estate, where we have the retail exposure or, you know, entertainment, hospitality-based real estate, a bit of a heavier discount there. You can see the zero discount on private debt and infrastructure, and that's because we got updated Q1 values in those asset classes that had already taken a mark for kind of Q1 COVID downturn adjustments. So the current market value adjustment is 27.7%. That compares to 30.4% that we reported to you guys last quarter. So we'll continue doing this until, you know, everything's been updated across the portfolio. So that could take a while, given kind of we still, you know, we're in July. We don't have year numbers for two of the big private equity assets. But any questions on what we're doing here or what the implications of it are? Okay, so there's a detailed schedule in the closed session that reviews kind of asset by asset what the discount is, what the rationale is for that discount.
Ryan, one question I have. I mean, the stock equity market, public markets have rebounded a lot from the bottom. In your analysis, are you giving any account to that, or because are you looking at these as specific energy-focused assets that the discounts haven't been lessened a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, we've looked at that. I mean, the smaller mid-cap indexes are not up as much. You know, maybe it's my skepticism of the rebound that we haven't adjusted it. But, you know, with the bulk of the discount is on the energy assets, and if you look at some of the public proxies there, they're way down. So until we kind of get to a more sustained recovery where we see those sectors that we're in bounce back as well, we'd probably, you know, still do the adjustment. In certain cases where we've talked to the managers about what's going on and they have more confidence in the valuation, we've reduced the discount. But for the big ones, you know, we've kind of kept them where we started in April.
Okay.
Yeah, and so, Bill, we took a hard look at that. Ryan, you know, he thinks about this kind of with small cap and by asset class, and some of the things that he's looked at that we didn't mention, I mean, is that he talked about we have energy, but it's not broad-based energy. It's very heavy shale energy, you know, so that's not going to come back like the, you know, say, an energy ETF. And, you know, energy ETF is still down, and we think that's kind of appropriate for what we have, and kind of also talked about some of the valuation issues that we think was already embedded in private equity before COVID came. And, you know, same thing with real estate. I mean, the entire market's, you know, up, and that's a lot of that's driven by the tech and growth stocks. But, you know, that is kind of in the range of, you know, what REITs are doing. Back to you, Ryan.
Thanks for that.
Guys, I have kind of, I mean, I don't even know how to say this, but like the implications of such a haircut has actually larger implications on the fund. I mean, are we going to discuss that at some point?
Well, we've talked about this, and, you know, how this fits into how we think about the actuarial and our payments and, you know, rebalancing. And so it's we're always thinking about that and considering kind of the potential that we have for the fund value to be actually lower than it is, and also the potential for the fund value to resume. So what we're trying to show here is, or not resume, but to return and rebound. What we're showing here is kind of what we think is, you know, kind of up to the minute, you know, our view, and we're trying to indicate that stress. And we don't want to overemphasize or, you know, what this is, or, you know, underemphasize kind of what a rough estimate it is. And so, you know, there's a reason that we have, you know, appraisals and auditors and things, so that, you know, you can't take kind of these rough estimates by staff and take them much farther than we have, I think. And Kelly, you might have, you know, some additional thoughts on that as well. We've talked about that over time.
No, I agree with what you think, Ken. I mean, we're not booking these entries as accounting entries or anything, but we feel like it's really important when we're looking at, you know, rebalancing considerations, that we're not ignoring kind of what might be a better look of reality, just because we don't have reporting yet. So we're just trying to get the best idea of what the portfolio is worth at any given time, even though, you know, it certainly isn't ideal, but we feel like it's better than, you know, ignoring the situation that's right in front of us and waiting for actual reporting.
And on the private market portfolio, a lot of times the appraisal schedule's a year in once a year, so it wouldn't be getting kind of updated values until, you know, April of next year. So, but like I said, a few of the managers have taken interim updates, but typically it's, you know, you see the big valuation swings at year end. So by the time we get to that, hopefully they're all priced in.
Okay.
Before the market's recovered.
Well, I mean, like what Bill was saying, there's often a lag between the private markets and the public markets, correct? I mean, more
yeah.
or less. So I'm just trying to think about it holistically of like these kind of things. And I guess it's just to say that things are, we got to keep an eye on it, I guess, to your earlier point.
It's maybe a more realistic view, but we may be looking at, you know, somewhere between the $600 and $800 million as being what we will actually achieve. And a lot of that's dependent on other things like what we're going to talk about in Lone Star and the rebound in the energy market. I mean, it's just a lot that goes into the HUP numbers. That fluctuated $100 million last year up.
Yep.
We expect that'll probably come back down this year, the $100 million.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, where it matters, we're looking at both numbers and, you know, anywhere in between. So. Okay, so no other questions on the adjustment. I'll move ahead to slide 61. This is where we're looking at the estimates of future net inflows. The blue dotted line is based on the reported book value. NAV, so a higher amount because of the higher beginning market value. The orange dotted line is based on the NAV adjustment projections. So you can see quite a bit lower than it was a year ago. You know, due to COVID, we basically pushed everything, almost everything into 2021, or, you know, everything kind of got pushed back 6 to 12 months. On the following slide, this is where you would see any dotted line, this orange line, any change quarter to quarter. They said at the outset there really was no significant change quarter to quarter. Then jump to 63, close out. This shows the kind of maroon shaded bar is the legacy assets and the composition of the total private market portfolio that those make up. We can see here kind of not a ton of activity through year end, but just we hammer it every time, but just keep in mind, you know, HUP, Lone Star, AEW, Red kind of make up 52% of the private portfolio and 95% of the legacy. So that's what's going to be what moves the needle and what it takes to kind of get out of the legacy assets. So, any questions on any of the projections, any detail, or anything else, I guess?
Are you going to cover any more of the slides, or is that are you?
That's the final. Yeah, that's the last one.
Okay.
There's one more slide, but nothing to cover there. It's just standard.
Okay.
Part of the package.
Any questions for Ryan or Kent? Okay, not hearing anything. We are going to shortly go into closed session to cover four items, so I think we'll be there a good hour or so. Why don't we open it up? If anybody that's from the public wants to make a comment at this stage, we'll let you have an opportunity to do that. What do they have to press 5-star, John?
Yes, that's correct. If they'll press 5-star, I can unmute them.
Okay, if you could do that, and we'll give you a minute or two, and then we'll go to closed session, and I guess people want to hang on, I guess they can, but we don't have very much to cover. We will come back into open just to consider any resolutions that come out of our session. You see anything, John?
No, I have no breakdowns.
Okay. If that's the case, then we will end the open session now and go into closed session to cover the real estate, the Lone Star, the legal issues, a medical issue, and the investment advisory committee issue. So we've got about 5 items to cover.
What are we going to be doing first?
We would be doing, we're scheduled to do the real estate. Are those folks ready, or are they, or are we ahead of schedule?
We're ahead of schedule.
We could do the IAC, the medical, and the legal item first.
Okay, why don't we do that then? Why don't we go into closed session, and we'll do those.